From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Jill Carroll is free. The kidnapped freelance reporter was seized in Baghdad 3 months ago. We'll talk to one of her friends. Then Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff sentenced to nearly 6 years in jail.
On the day that Jack Abramoff was sentenced for the lobbying and ethics violations, the Senate passed a lobbying bill, but it didn't go far enough. Chances are they think the voters will be happy. My guess is the voters will say it's time they really went far enough to clean up Washington.
Shelley Pengree of Common Cause will also talk to her about a speech she gave on the USA Patriot Act to the League of Women Voters. The group was visited by the FBI soon after. But first, more on the immigration debate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After nearly 3 months in captivity, kidnapped U.S. reporter Jill Carroll has been released. Carroll is a freelance reporter working for the Christian Science Monitor in Iraq. She was seized in January outside the offices of a prominent Sunni politician in Baghdad. There had been no word from her captors in nearly 2 months. They demanded the release of all women detainees in Iraqi prisons. Five out of an estimated 9 women prisoners were released in January. Carroll's editor, David Cook, said she had spoken to her family and was in good condition. On Wednesday, Jill Carroll's sister, Katie, had read a statement on Arab television pleading for her sister's safe release. In other Iraq news, Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri has lashed out at growing U.S. pressure to block him from serving a second term as prime minister. U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad has asked Iraqi Shia politicians to seek the withdrawal of al-Jafri's nomination for a second term. In an interview with the New York Times, al-Jafri said, quote, "There's concern among the Iraqi people that the democratic process is being threatened." Former Liberian leader Charles Taylor has been returned to his country to face war crimes charges. Taylor had been living in exile in Nigeria. He was caught Wednesday trying to enter neighboring Cameroon. In Washington, President Bush praised the arrest in a joint appearance with the Nigerian President Obasanjo.
My visit last week with the president of Liberia, we talked about Charles Taylor, the fact that Charles Taylor will be brought to justice in a court of law, will help Liberia, and is a signal, Mr. President, of your deep desire for there to be peace in your neighborhood.
This news on Iran. After months of diplomatic negotiations, the Security Council has approved a statement calling on Iran to suspend uranium enrichment efforts. Both U.S. and Russian officials who've clashed over Iran's nuclear activities hailed the measure as a compromise. In other news, Abdulrahman, the Afghan citizen who faced a possible death sentence for converting to Christianity, has arrived in Italy, where he's been granted political asylum. Rahman was arrested 2 weeks ago. Under Afghanistan's laws, no one has the right to contravene Islam. Canada has become the first foreign government outside Israel to suspend aid to the Palestinian Authority over the recent election of Hamas. Canada says the aid freeze will continue so long as Hamas refuses to recognize Israel and renounce violence. Several other countries are expected to follow suit. The announcement came as Hamas members formally took control of the Palestinian cabinet on Wednesday. Here in the United States, an Arab-American man has been sentenced to 30 years in prison for joining al-Qaeda and plotting to assassinate President Bush. Ahmed Omar Abu Ali was convicted in November after spending nearly 2 years in a Saudi Arabian prison where he says he was tortured into making a confession. Two doctors who examined him corroborated his claim. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved a new bill to restrict government lobbying. The bill would deny senators gifts and meals from lobbyists and limit their ability to insert special interest provisions in large spending bills. The measure was immediately criticized for containing several loopholes and not introducing any enforcement mechanisms. On Tuesday, the Senate overwhelmingly defeated a proposal to create an independent office that would investigate ethics complaints against members of Congress. Fred Wertheimer, the president of the watchdog group Democracy 21, said, quote, "This is nothing to write home about. The argument they seemed to make was trust us." In New Orleans, two police officers and one current officer have been indicted for their role in the beating of an unarmed man who was caught on videotape. The attack occurred last October. Robert Davis, a 64-year-old retired teacher, was walking in the city's French Quarter when police accosted him. The officers hit Davis at least four times in the head, dragged him to the ground, kneed him in the back. Davis was left bleeding on the ground. In Washington, five former FISA court judges have urged Congress to reject the Bush administration's argument it holds the inherent authority to conduct warrantless eavesdropping. Appearing before a Senate judiciary hearing on Tuesday, the judges voiced support for a measure proposed by Republican Senator Arlen Specter to grant the court a formal role in overseeing government surveillance. In other news, Michael Berg, whose son Nick Berg was beheaded after he was kidnapped in Iraq, has announced a bid for Congress in Delaware. Michael Berg has repeatedly blamed the Bush administration's invasion and occupation of Iraq for his son's death. He said he was approached by representatives of the Democratic Party, but will run with the Green Party because, quote, the Democrats have the money to get the message out, but they have the wrong message. In Detroit, a former federal prosecutor and a government official have been indicted for unlawful conduct in an attempt to convict four Muslim men arrested after 9/11. The prosecutor, Richard Convertino, and State Department official, Harry Raymond Smith, were charged with conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and making false declarations in the case. In a major embarrassment to the Bush administration, two of the suspects' convictions were overturned after it was disclosed prosecutors did not turn over key evidence. An investigation by the New York Times later revealed the Justice Department pressured prosecutors to continue with the case despite the lack of clear evidence. Critics labeled Convertino's indictment as an attempt to crack down on a government whistleblower. In 2004, Convertino filed a lawsuit against then-Attorney General John Ashcroft, accusing him of gross mismanagement in the government's handling of terrorism cases. And a major figure in the Puerto Rican independence movement has been arrested in San Juan. On Tuesday, the FBI arrested Antonio Camacho Negron for allegedly violating the terms of his parole. The arrest comes just months after independence leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios was killed in a federal raid. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. After nearly 3 months in captivity, kidnapped U.S. reporter Jill Carroll has been released. Carroll, a freelance reporter working with the Christian Science Monitor, was seized in January outside the offices of a prominent Sunni politician in Baghdad. There has been no word from her captors in nearly 2 months. David Cook, her editor, said Carroll had spoken to her family and was in good condition. On Wednesday, Jill Carroll's sister, Katie Carroll, had read a statement on Arab television pleading for her sister's safe release.
We're joined on the line by Matt Vothur, a friend of Jill Carroll's. He's a reporter for the Daily Hampshire Gazette. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hey, thank you.
Your reaction to the news of Jill's release?
In a lot of ways, it's still sinking in, but it's certainly an overwhelming sense of just relief, absolutely.
Can you talk about Jill? Can you talk about first what you've heard, how she's been released, and then who Jill is?
I've gotten kind of bits and pieces from different news accounts and from TV and satellite radio and everything, just trying to piece it all together. I just saw the video of her that was, I guess, taken within the past couple hours, and she looks good, which is really a relief. You know, we had no idea what it would seem like. I knew Jill when she was a college student, and this was something that she dreamed of doing, was being a foreign correspondent and doing important work.
Where did she go to college?
She went to the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And I think that was something she always wanted to do. I apologize. I'm not totally composed yet.
We understand. And by the way, congratulations on Jill's release. Just for all of Jill's friends I know who have worked so hard, as well as her family. Jill went to Jordan before she went to Iraq, and Jill learned Arabic.
Yeah, she thought that she wouldn't be able to be as effective unless she learned to speak Arabic, and I think that that's been kind of a well-chronicled thing about her, and I really think that in a lot of senses that served her really well. I think the outpouring of support that everybody saw from the Iraqi people and from people there. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that she respected their culture and went out of her way to learn about it so she could better tell their stories.
In the news reports that have come out, she indicated in her the initial statement that she'd been treated well, but that she had very little knowledge of what was going on in the outside world, or very much about her captors as well.
Yeah, I saw the same thing. It's obviously early. It's obviously early, and I'll be paying attention all day to try to learn and see what. More of that sort of thing. I think it's kind of a little too early for me right now to comment on that. I mean, that's obviously, if that's true, and certainly I can't imagine she would lie about that. So I that's great news, absolutely.
Joe was an unembedded reporter.
Right. Yeah. No. She wasn't with a military unit. She didn't have bodyguards and things like that. She walked the streets and interviewed everyday Iraqi. She dressed in the traditional garb and was able to be out and talking to people.
And her translator, though, was killed when she was captured and kidnapped.
Right, yeah.
Well, Matt Vautour, I want to thank you very much for being with us, friend of Joe Carroll, college classmate, University of Massachusetts. Thanks so much for being with us. Again, the latest news is the freelance reporter Joe Carroll is free. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to the Senate. Juan?
Yes. Well, the Senate begins debate today on legislation to overhaul the nation's immigration laws. On Monday, the Senate Judiciary Committee approved a bill that includes a number of enforcement measures as well as a way for the 11 million undocumented immigrants living in this country to have a chance to work here legally and eventually become U.S. citizens. On Wednesday, Bush spoke up for the first time in favor of a guest worker program that leads to citizenship. He did not take a stand, though, on the legalization issue. Bush arrived in Cancun, Mexico, last night and is scheduled to meet with Mexican President Vicente Fox today. The issue of immigration will likely dominate the agenda. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper will also participate in the talks.
Back in Washington, the debate on the Senate Judiciary Committee bill is expected to end by next week before the Senate leaves on recess. Any Senate bill would have to be reconciled with a House bill passed in December that's been described as the most repressive immigration bill in 70 years. House Bill 4437 would, among other things, make every undocumented immigrant a felon and make it a crime for priests, nuns, healthcare workers, social workers to offer help to undocumented immigrants. The bill sparked historic protests across the country, including upwards of 1 million people taking to the streets in Los Angeles this last weekend at what may have been California's largest demonstration in history, as well as tens of thousands of students walking out of high schools across the country. For more on the immigration reform issue, we're joined by Michelle Waslin. She's director of immigration policy research at the National Council of La Raza, the country's largest Latino civil rights and advocacy group. Juan?
Well, Michelle, can you tell us what the situation looks like now in Washington as the debate begins to unfold in the Senate? It appears that the Judiciary Committee bill will be the first one debated instead of the FRIST bill that would be an echo of the House 4437 bill.
Right. There are two bills currently being debated in the Senate. The Senate Judiciary Committee passed a very comprehensive bill on a bipartisan basis on Monday. This bill includes a path to citizenship for current undocumented immigrants. It creates a new temporary worker program so that new workers can come to the country legally in the future. It reduces family immigration backlogs. And it also includes many harsh enforcement measures. Now, at the same time, Senator Bill Frist introduced his own bill, which is very similar to the bill passed by the House of Representatives in December. So I think the next couple of days of debate are going to be incredibly interesting. We know that the Senate is divided. We know that the Republicans are divided on the issue of immigration. And I think that it's time for the Senate to decide whether they're going to pass another message bill that makes it look like they're tough on immigration, or if they're really ready to roll up their sleeves and do the hard work of passing a comprehensive solution that will actually fix the underlying problems.
Well, meanwhile, the protests are continuing. Yesterday in Nashville, 15,000 immigrants and Latinos protested in one of the largest marches in that city's history. But the front page article of the New York Times today talking about how the Republican Party has already been damaged in terms of winning support among Latinos. And this is coming from Latino Republicans who are furious about what's been happening in this debate. Your sense of though the issue of when the Senate bill, whatever Senate bill comes out, and you yourself have said it has real problems in terms of tougher, much tougher enforcement provisions, will the final bill that eventually comes out even be worth supporting, or should people just wait until the congressional elections in November and try again next year when there may be a much more sympathetic Congress?
Well, I think that that's really difficult to answer at this moment. Certainly, there are many problematic features in the House bill and in the Senate bill. However, I do know that there is bipartisan support for real comprehensive reform. We see Senators McCain and Kennedy joined on the same bill. We saw bipartisan support in the Judiciary Committee. I think that people from both parties know that the business groups, organized labor, ethnic groups, immigrant rights groups, the churches, are all in favor of a comprehensive immigration bill. And you certainly don't want to alienate any of those major groups, especially during an election year. So I think that there's still a great opportunity for the Senate to be reasonable and rational and pass a good comprehensive solution. But unfortunately, as you mentioned, whatever the Senate passes will have to be reconciled with the House bill. And that is going to be very difficult unless the House makes a sudden change and decides that it can support a more comprehensive approach to immigration reform.
And Michelle, can you explain that House bill, what you find is the most egregious aspects of it?
Wow, it's difficult to choose just a few. First of all, I think that the bill has been mislabeled a border security bill. While there certainly are measures to enhance security, increase the number of Border Patrol agents at the border, this bill goes far beyond border security. It also goes far beyond punishing undocumented immigrants. This bill would have a very serious negative impact on legal immigrants and even on U.S. citizens. For example, it severely limits the due process rights of immigrants living legally in this country, making it much easier for them to be deported quickly without any chance to see a judge. It would make it much more difficult for legal permanent residents to become U.S. citizens. And then, of course, there are the provisions we've all heard about, that it would make all undocumented immigrants felons. It would also broaden the definition of smuggling, transporting, aiding, harboring, so that many social service workers, humanitarian aid providers, could be found guilty and prosecuted of smuggling and aiding and abetting. The bill also gives inherent authority to all state and local police to enforce all immigration laws. So we have a very potentially dangerous situation.
Doesn't it provide funding for a 700-mile wall along the Mexican border?
Yes, it does. It would build additional fencing in urban areas, which we fear would really drive migrants toward more rural areas where it's much more dangerous to cross, and we'd fear that it would increase the number of deaths along the border.
Michelle Wasland, you're inside the Beltway, we're outside, and so are the massive protests, unprecedented on any issue around the country. What effect do those protests have inside Washington?
Well, certainly everybody is talking about it. The senators have mentioned it every step of the way. They can't help but notice that many of their constituents are out marching, demanding comprehensive reform, demanding responsible action. I think it's incredibly exciting that finally the immigrant voice is being heard. For too long, the Minutemen and other anti-immigrant groups have really dominated the debate on this, and it's about time that the other side of this debate has its voice heard. And, of course, the marchers are not all undocumented immigrants. These are U.S. citizens, legal immigrants that are demonstrating their support for their communities, their family members. And I certainly hope that Congress will begin to pay more notice to them.
Michelle Wasland, thank you very much for being with us, Director of Immigration Policy Research at the National Council of LADASA, the country's largest Latino civil rights and advocacy group. And I just want to end with the comment to Michelle and Juan. on who is protesting. As Michelle pointed out, legal immigrants, but also undocumented immigrants. And there takes a lot of bravery, especially in a climate when, for example, in New York, you have the New York police just admitting that they're not only videotaping protesters in general, but they're saving those videotapes. So if the law is passed, and already there are very serious laws around immigrants without documents, but if these laws are passed, there's a lot of videotape out there.
Yes, and it definitely takes considerable bravery, much more than your normal protester, for someone who is living in the shadows in this country already to come out and participate in these kinds of protests.
So I think it would be conservative to say that probably these unprecedented protests would be even larger.
Yes. But interestingly, I think that a lot of the protesters, as Michelle mentioned, are legal residents and citizens, because there was a new poll that just came out from Sergio Bendixson's group that shows that as many as 80% of U.S. Latino citizens are supporting, believe that immigrants are producing greater benefits to the country and believe that they're being scapegoated. So I think that there's a wellspring of massive support in the Latino and immigrant community in general.
Here in New York, the protests have not been as large, but organizers say they expect tens of thousands of people to make their way over the Brooklyn Bridge on Saturday as part of this nationwide rally over the proposed changes to the nation's immigration laws.
Yes, and then on April 10th, all around the country, labor unions and immigrant rights groups are trying to coordinate a national day of protest for April 10th around the issue. So I think these are going to continue up until the Senate decides one way or until Congress decides and the president decides one way or another how they're going to stand on this.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll look at the case of Jack Abramoff. Stay with us.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Made for you and me. As I went walking down that ribbon of a highway, I saw the me of that endless skyway. Now I saw below me.
Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, This Land is Your Land, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has overwhelmingly approved imposing new rules governing the relations between lawmakers and lobbyists. The 90-8 vote came just hours after Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff was sentenced to nearly 6 years in jail. Under the bill, lobbyists would no longer be allowed to shower senators with meals and gifts. Lobbyists would be required to disclose more about their dealings with lawmakers, and it will become harder for senators to insert pet projects and laws into spending bills at the behest of lobbyists.
But critics say the Senate could have done much more to break the stranglehold lobbyists have on lawmakers. Two of the Senate's most vocal advocates for lobbying reform, Democrat Russ Feingold and Republican John McCain, both voted against the bill, which McCain described as, quote, very, very weak. This is in part because the Senate decided not to address one of the most pressing issues, campaign finance. According to the New York Times, the bill does little to break the link between lobbyists and lawmakers' money-raising machines. The bill steers clear of regulating the fundraising activities of lobbyists. This will allow lobbyists to continue running political action committees for the same lawmakers they hope to influence and to peddle campaign donations to lawmakers via their clients.
The Senate vote came just hours after Abramoff was sentenced to 70 months in prison on fraud charges stemming from his purchase of a Florida casino. Abramoff is still awaiting sentencing on federal charges of bribing government officials and defrauding at least four Native American tribes out of tens of millions of dollars. He is at the heart of what is turning out to be one of the largest congressional scandals in history.
To talk about the Senate vote on lobbying and the sentencing of Jack Abramoff, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Shelley Pingree, president of Common Cause. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
Shelley, before we talk about this, I wanted to ask you a quick question.
Sure.
And that is about a recent speech that you gave.
Sure. You want to hear about my visit to Michigan?
Yes.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. You know, what could be more mom and apple pie than Common Cause and the League of Women Voters? And I went to a very small town outside of Chicago for a forum on freedom of information and sunshine laws, and talked about the Patriot Act and a variety of things that are, you know, on people's minds today. And after it appeared in the newspaper, the head of the local League of Women Voters got a call from the FBI saying that we had mischaracterized the Patriot Act. He thought it was inappropriate that we didn't have someone from the federal government there to debate. And I just have to say, again, you know, it's about as wonky and boring as you can get sometimes to have a group of people who are willing to come out on a, you know, in an evening to talk about these issues, and for the FBI to be calling up the League of Women Voters and Common Cause and saying maybe we ought to curtail our speech was certainly what seemed to be inappropriate and bordered on intimidation.
Did they offer to supply speakers as well, become booking agents for the Patriot Act?
They did. And I have to say, Kay Maxwell, who's the national president of the League of Women Voters, and I were in a meeting yesterday. And, you know, both of us had to remark, doesn't the FBI have more important things to do than worrying about people like us talking about freedom of information and sunshine laws? I think what's troubling about it is it really shows how far off the map some of these agencies are. And, you know, we're probably above intimidation, but think of the people who are being put in positions that are made to feel uncomfortable. This is about democracy. We weren't even talking about the war in Iraq or anything that's, you know, challenging sort of issues in our country. We're just talking about how people get access to information.
Well, let's talk about Jack Abramoff. And let us know afterwards if you get any calls after the program.
Yeah, I know. You'd think I would after this, but, you know, who knows?
But tell us about the sentencing of Jack Abramoff. Looks like he is sentenced to something like 6 years in prison.
Right, and it was somewhat lenient based on both the fact that he was very remorseful and, as you know, has been cooperating with federal officials, revealing a tremendous amount of information that still has people nervous here in Washington and has started to implicate some other members of Congress and staff, but is likely to go much further. What I thought was interesting is, as you were talking about the convergence here of the Senate passing somewhat of a weak bill and Abramoff being sentenced on the same day, he's the man whose scandals have really cracked open stories about many things that people didn't understand were going on in Washington. Here you have Abramoff already on the path to redemption, and Congress, who should be looking for redemption from their constituents and probably have much more redeeming to do, not going nearly far enough. So maybe our criminal gets redeemed first, and it takes Congress a little bit longer to really do what the American public is expecting them to do.
And how does this tie into lobbying laws, that the lobbying law that was just passed?
Well, the sentencing of Abramoff is not unrelated to the separate sentencing that will also go on in Washington that is about corruption and bribery. But as you mentioned, this was about gambling cruise ship lines, and he's actually being sentenced there for fraudulently attempting to access loans. But there was a tie between him, his operation down there, and Representative Ney, who put something in the congressional record to try to smooth this deal. So these things are not unrelated, and it could get more sorted as we find out more of the details.
Of course, he is cooperating, and there is a lot of concern, I'm sure, in the halls of Congress about what he is going to be telling law enforcement officials about what he did in Washington. Your sense of the impact of this on any any efforts or continuing efforts to reform the way business is done there?
Well, I think it was John McCain who said yesterday when he voted against the lobbying bill that was put forward, he said the good news is there will be more indictments. And you got a very responsive Congress when things make them nervous enough but give them a little bit of space, as they've gotten from the last set of allegations that came out around Abramoff, and they started to get a little bit too comfortable. So in a sense, the good news is Jack Abramoff is talking. He's going to stay out of jail for another 90 days to keep cooperating. And basically, they got all his emails. There are boxes and boxes of information being stored and gone through right now. So chances are we're going to hear a lot more about how far these scandals went into the offices of members of Congress, their staffs, the executive branch offices. I think there's much more that we're going to hear.
Shelley Pengree, talk more about what you came to understand about Jack Abramoff as the story broke, about the representation of misrepresentation of Native American tribes, about the extent to which his relationship, how far his relationship went with, for example, Tom DeLay, now indicted.
Right. Well, as you know, Tom DeLay at one point said Jack Abramoff was one of his closest friends. Of course, everyone today is trying to pretend that they didn't meet Jack Abramoff. They don't know him. Representative Ney is saying he was duped. He didn't understand what he was putting in the congressional record. But I think it will be clear as we see more and more revelations and as more indictments come out and more comes out from the Justice Department, that there were very close ties and that, frankly, many members of Congress in the House and the Senate were assisting him in his efforts to help certain Native American tribes, basically directly related to gambling. He was interested in helping some tribes beat out other tribes in this very, very lucrative business of gambling and the rules around that. And it was extremely far-reaching. Again, there's much more that we're going to learn, but a lot of this started to come out when Senator McCain's committee opened up the investigations around this. Again, I think that members of Congress, had a very uncomfortable Christmas waiting for the indictments to come down. Then they got a little bit more comfortable as they started to deal with some of these issues and how to reform them. But I think we will continue to hear much more as this 90 days continues and there are more revelations that come out.
We're talking to Shelley Pengree, who heads Common Cause. We wanted to ask you about a report you just put out. It's called Wolves in Sheep's Clothing, and it's about the telecom industry lobbying right now and their what you call front groups. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, you can find the full report on our website, commoncause.org. And basically, what we wanted to talk a little bit about was the lobbying activity that's going on now as the reauthorization of the Telecom Act comes up. As you recall, the Telecom Act was put forward first in 1996. And consumers were told, this is going to be a great thing. We're going to have enhanced competition, much more variety, and your rates will go down for cable TV and other services. Well, I think everyone knows that a decade later, there's far less competition, there's more media consolidation, and people's rates have increased 40 and 50% without the promises that they were offered. So people are already disappointed, and industry sees this as an incredible opportunity for making a lot of money out there. So our report actually deals with this AstroTurf lobbying. I mean, we're all getting so familiar with it in any kind of big industry debate that goes on today, these front groups that make you think that they're somehow on your side. One of them is called Consumers for Cable Choice, and they run a website called mycablenightmare.org. Well, actually, they're backed by Verizon and AT&T, and Verizon and AT&T and the cable companies, they're all at war with each other because they really want to own the biggest share of this consumer market. And so they make you think that they've got these websites, they want to hear your stories, they lobby Congress, they get you to send in postcards, they do a whole variety of things. And what we really just wanted to put forward is making sure people know where these groups get their money. They're not Consumers Union. They're not Common Cause. They're not organizations that don't take money from industry and really do lobby on behalf of the consumer. A lot of these groups are think tanks that get funded by industry, put out reports that are clearly biased. And we just think in this very important debate, members of Congress need to know where this information is coming from. And when you see these ads in the newspaper or on TV, you realize that it's really just somebody who's trying to make a buck off of you, not trying to make your world of how you access the media any better.
One of the groups, FreedomWorks, has a familiar figure running it. Could you talk about that group in particular?
Yeah. Dick Armey is very involved in that. He's the chair. And, you know, they say they fight for lower taxes, less government, and more economic freedom. But, in fact, they get a lot of contributions from Verizon, SBC, which is now AT&T. And they have a website or a campaign called Choose Your Cable. You know, again, it's not unlike what happened during the Medicare debate, on energy debates. You know, you hear about these groups, and they have these mom and apple pie names, and you think, wow, you know, they're on my side. And people they're angry about a lot of these things, and they want things to change. But you basically get duped most of the time. By thinking that they're working for you, and frankly, they're not.
Of course, Dick Armey was the right-hand man of Newt Gingrich, former congressmember for many terms.
You know, not much changes here in Washington.
Well, one of the things some of these groups are doing is they're attempting to enlist many minority organizations around the country and trying to, the telecom industry, trying to get the many of the minority groups to line up against the cable industry. And I had an interesting conversation recently. I'm the former president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and I was talking with a staff member there a couple of days ago who told me that late last week the association got a call from Mike McCurry, the former White House press secretary, who's cold calling organizations, lining them up to support the telecoms and some legislation. And the staff member told Mr. McCurry, oh, yes, yeah, we're familiar with this issue. We work very closely with Robert McChesney, and the media democracy movement, whereupon he tells me that McCurry quickly became very cold and wanted to cut off the conversation immediately as soon as he realized that this was one group that knew a little bit about what's going on with media policy in the country.
You know, Juan, I find this very interesting because when I was covering the White House, Mike McCurry was the press secretary for President Clinton, and the way these press briefings work every day when Mike McCurry would come out. You know, it's not a very fancy room, but the chairs are gold-plated, the front row seats, that is. Each one has a little gold plate that says Wall Street Journal, NBC, ABC. And so when the president was going to hold a news conference, you know, I was going to go and hopefully ask the president a question, they said, no, I would be able to go into an overflow room. I said, no, I didn't want to watch the president on television. I wanted to ask him a question. They said, well, I would have to ask the White House reporters, the press corps, the head of it. And I said, so I'm going to ask, Pacifica's going to ask permission of General Electric, Viacom, right? General Electric owns NBC, Viacom, which at the time owned CBS, Cap Cities, which owned ABC at the time, Dow Jones, which owned the Wall Street Journal. But I find what's interesting about this comment is that the former White House press secretary, Mike McCurry, is really lobbying for the further consolidation of the media, the very White House press corps that he, where he was supposed to be encouraging free press and free speech.
Well, in terms of one of the big issues with the telecoms is this this whole concern of theirs that they are now going into cable, providing cable service. Verizon calls it Fios, and where they because their market is mature now for telephones, and they're not going to grow anymore on landlines. So they are trying to get the government to basically exempt them from having to go city by city, as the cable companies did, to win franchise approval from local governments. They want it all done at the national and the state level. And this is one of the things I think that Army's group is very involved in.
It's true.
And your response to that effort? And
well, again, you know, I mean, one of our concerns is that this is an inside-the-industry fight for, just as you said, a market share and an opportunity to make a lot more money. We haven't seen in the past that any of these organizations, major corporations, have been on our side as consumers or as people who want more diversity in the media. So why would they be on our side now? And basically what they're doing is spending a tremendous amount of money in an internal kind of debate between these players in the telecom industry trying to make you think that one of them is going to do what's right for you. And I don't think there's any possible argument here that shows that there's something that's going to end up being better for consumers. It's not been good in the past.
But isn't it a little more than just a battle within the industry? Because by the phone companies seeking to abrogate the rights of local municipalities to exact some sort of agreements with these cable providers, they're in essence centralizing government control at the federal level over telecommunications and limiting the possibility of the public being able to hold these media companies accountable through their local municipal and state governments.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, this idea of having a federal franchise is clearly designed to take, a local voice out of it. And it's true. One of the few voices that consumers and activists continue to have today is over cable contracts and how they're negotiated, local cable councils, local access TV in some places. So you're absolutely right. This is one of the last sort of holds that we have. And you've seen over the last two decades, citizens in our country have really lost control over the broadcast airwaves, over many of the rules that govern them. And I think the big giants clearly are just looking for more and more ways to continue to take that away from us.
And while the telecom industry and the cable industry are competing with each other, they do seem to agree on one thing, and that's doing away with public access. And this is a big crisis in the country because those are the locally negotiated franchises with cable companies in each municipality.
Absolutely. It's one of the few ways we still have an ability to interact here. What you can see is, as technology gets more and more sophisticated, our fights continue to change. You know, we spend a lot of time fighting over the broadcast airwaves and lost a tremendous amount, and we should still stay in those fights about media ownership and public interest obligation. But now it's shifting into issues like this, issues around net neutrality, how information is going to start coming to us in the future, and whether there will be holds on those kinds of free and open access. Frankly, these guys are very smart. They're fighting us on all fronts, and there's a lot of battles.
Well, Shelley Pingree, I want to thank you very much for being with us, head of Common Cause. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
Money, that's what I want. Flying lizards here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We return now to the issue of lobbying, specifically how lobbyists help secure billions in taxpayer subsidies for the oil and gas industry. Earlier this week, the New York Times exposed that the government stands to lose between $20 and $80 billion because of a provision passed by Congress 10 years ago subsidizing oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. At the time, the vote in Congress received little attention, with the exception perhaps of lobbyists from the oil and gas industry.
The New York Times set the scene like this. It was after midnight, and every lawmaker in the committee room wanted to go home. But there was still time to sweeten a deal encouraging oil and gas companies to drill in the Gulf of Mexico. There is no cost, declared Representative Joe Barton, a Texas Republican who was presiding over congressional negotiations on the sprawling energy bill last July. An obscure provision on new drilling incentives was so non-controversial, he added, that senior House and Senate negotiators had not even discussed it.
Mr. Barton's claim had a long history. For more than a decade, lawmakers and administration officials, both Republicans and Democrats, have promised there would be no cost to taxpayers for a program allowing companies to avoid paying the government royalties on oil and gas produced in publicly owned waters in the Gulf. Now, a new report by the Government Accountability Office estimates that because of this so-called non-controversial provision, the oil and gas industry will be able to avoid paying between $20 and $80 billion in royalties to the government.
We're joined now in Washington by Edmund Andrews. He's a reporter for The New York Times who's been closely covering this issue and exposed this story this week. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Why don't you lay out the story, the power of the oil industry?
Well, this story begins, as you said, about 10 years ago when Congress passed a law. It was actually an amendment to another energy bill that gave incentives to companies drilling in deep waters in the Gulf of Mexico. The idea was to get companies out into these high-cost, high-risk areas. The government would give them a break on the royalties that they would normally be paying the government for drilling in public waters. The idea was, though, that this break on royalties, which can add up to billions of dollars, would be available in times of fairly low prices. But if oil and gas prices went, climbed sharply, above $34 a barrel for crude oil, for example, then that break on the royalties would stop. Essentially, what's happened over the intervening years is that for a variety of reasons, having to do with lobbying, having to do with shrewd litigation, having to do with just the ambiguities that lawmakers didn't notice in their own legislation, this incentive has ballooned. It's ballooned in value because the sales value of oil and gas has climbed so sharply, and because, as it turns out, a lot of production out in the Gulf is still going to be royalty-free, even though we have historically high prices right now. And one of the things that astonished me in reporting on this story over the last several months was that this actually came as a surprise to expert lawmakers on the Hill, the people who had been behind this legislation 10 years ago, who had supported its extension and enhancement in more recent times, as recently as last year. They didn't seem to know, most of them, that in fact we were going to be giving up billions of dollars in royalties over the next 5 years. The story of how that happens is basically the way I would sum it up is it's sort of a textbook Washington story of a law that gets passed. It's sufficiently complicated that the only people who really pay attention to its implementation day in and day out, year in and year out, through all the legal subtleties, are the people with the most profit on the line, the oil and gas companies. The lawmakers stop paying attention. They don't carry out much oversight on what happens in the years afterwards. And the administrators that actually implement the law slip up from time to time, and that's what happened here. They slip up, and then they come under pressure from the industry itself and voluntarily add sweeteners. It all happens so subtly and in such small steps you don't notice it until suddenly now we're in this situation where we're talking about billions and billions of dollars being given up over the next few years. And as you said, the GAO has estimated that over the long haul, 25 years, the government could be out anywhere from $20 to $80 billion. It's a tremendous amount of money.
Now, as your article indicates, when this provision was first developed, the price of a barrel of oil was about $16 a barrel. These days, it's $60 or higher on most days. So certainly, the people in the energy subcommittees in the House, as the price of oil continued to escalate, somebody must have been aware that this was, in essence, a huge break in the main of the government's cash flow. Wouldn't somebody have moved in recent years to try to fix this?
Well, there have been a couple. Sorry?
Go ahead.
There have been lawmakers on the Hill who have been critics and opponents of this program from the very start, and they did in fact try to kill off this program or at least rein it in, both in at various points when it came up on the House and Senate floors, whenever there was a chance for it to be brought up for discussion, they came out and opposed it. But essentially, the powers that be in Congress in the last few years were working on the assumption that this was actually a set of incentives that would not apply in the environment we're in right now, where you have oil at more than $60 a barrel. Their assumption was that these incentives had stopped kicking in at the moment and would only apply if oil dropped back down to, say, below $34 a barrel. And they were mistaken about that. Nobody seemed to realize as recently as, late last year, that in fact there's a lot of oil and gas that is going to be given away for free, essentially, even in this price environment. They just didn't realize it. They thought that they were locking in this kind of modest incentive program, when in fact it had been broken open in a series of small ways over the years, and just didn't know it. And I think the story is how a seemingly modest program that is complicated becomes shaped. Well, the outcome of that program is determined by a host of really small details. And in all the drama of high politics in Washington and, top policy priorities of an incoming administration, the details of an existing program, the ambiguities of a law that's already been passed, don't get much attention.
So are we to assume that now that the information is out and everyone knows about it, that Joe Barton in the House, who is from an energy state and is in charge of House energy policy, is moving rapidly now to close this loophole?
I don't think so. I don't know what Mr. Barton's view on this is at the moment, but the signals that I get from other House Republicans and from the Bush administration is that the money that's set to be given away over the next several years is essentially locked into the contracts that the government willingly signed in recent years. So their basic argument appears to be that there's nothing they can do, the damage is done, and they simply have to abide by these contracts. You do have a partisan sort of finger-pointing going on from both Democrats and Republicans. What the Republicans are trying to say is that essentially this problem would not have happened had not the Clinton administration fouled up on the contracts it signed during 2 years in 1998 and 1999. There is a lot of truth to this. There's partial truth to this. The leasing officials during the Clinton administration did make a really big mistake in all the leases that they signed in 2 years, where they sort of omitted this escape clause, clause that said you don't get these benefits if prices go beyond a certain level.
We're talking to Edmund Andrews, who's a New York Times reporter. You talk about ambiguities. What isn't ambiguous is in January, oil giant ExxonMobil reported it made a record $36 billion last year, a sum larger than the economies of 125 countries. Exxon became the first company to ever make more than $10 billion in a financial quarter. And during the last 3 months of 2005, the oil giant made over $1,300 every second, nearly $5 million $2 every hour. And the country's three major biggest oil companies, ExxonMobil, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips, earned a combined $63 billion last year. Finally, can you talk about the connection?
Well, most economists would agree that that the oil business is a high-risk business. It's also a cyclical one. You have really good times and really bad times. So there's nothing inherently wrong with making big, big profits in a moment of soaring environments. But one thing that I would point out here is that if you look at the politics of it, last year, as Congress was sort of locking in one more time these particular incentives, not realizing perhaps that they were already poised to cost taxpayers billions of dollars over the next 5 years. At the same time that they were doing that, the Bush administration, President Bush, went to the mat on the issue of a windfall profits tax. The Senate last October passed a tax cut extension bill, which included a one-year $5 billion windfall profits tax on the major oil companies. That issue is still not resolved. The House doesn't favor it. But my point is here that as soon as the Senate did that, the White House came out and very bluntly, powerfully said, if this is part of the tax bill, we will recommend a veto. The Bush administration, by contrast, did register opposition to adding new incentives for oil and gas drilling last year, but they didn't fight it. They merely noted their opposition. And that I think, tells you something about the sort of the priorities here, which fights they're willing to pick and which fights they're not willing to pick. They were not willing to do anything that irritated the oil companies, and they were willing to go to the mat for them.
Well, Edmund Andrews, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a reporter with the New York Times. And that does it for today's broadcast, except once again, this update. U.S. reporter Jill Carroll is freed in Iraq. Jill Carroll has given a brief interview on television in Baghdad. According to the Associated Press, she said she's in good condition, has been treated well by her captors. Her captors freed her by leaving her in a street near the offices of the Iraqi Islamic Party. Jill Carroll walked inside, and people there called U.S. officials. Although her captors threatened twice in videotapes to kill her, Jill Carroll said they never hit her or threatened to do so. Carroll said she was kept in a room with a window and a shower, but she did not know where she was. She went on to say, quote, "I'm just happy to be free. I want to be with my family." Again, the top news. Jill Carroll, the freelance reporter who is writing for the Christian Science Monitor, is free. Well, Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Massilio, our engineers. Special thanks to Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin and Megan Whitney. This Friday night, I'll be in Atlanta, Georgia, for a benefit for Damu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace, who continues to battle cancer. The event will start at 8 p.m. for our Atlanta viewers and listeners at the Hillside Chapel and Truth Center, 2450 Cascade Road in Southwest Atlanta. Among the other speakers, Reverend Joseph Lowry, Reverend C.T. Vivian, Reverend Timothy McDonald, all honoring Damu Smith. Then next week on Tuesday, I'll be at Brooklyn College, and Thursday night, I'll be at the Center School on West 70th Street in New York City, celebrating public education in New York City. And you can go to our website for all details. On Friday, we head to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We'll be speaking in Lafayette, Louisiana, and on Saturday night, celebrating KTUL. That's the radio station at Tulane University in New Orleans. On Monday, we'll be broadcasting. That's in two Mondays from New Orleans. And if people have suggestions for broadcasts, if you have comments on our shows, or if you'd like to get DVDs of our broadcast, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, as well as details on all speaking events. That does it for today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.